Good morning, everybody. It's time for the Pathway Hospice and Palliative Care Show. It's Elder Care Radio, only on News Radio 890-925-KDXU. Here's Richard and Kaylee.
This is another Wellness Wednesday, and it is exciting to be here. Yes, this is Elder Care Radio, and brought to you by Pathway Hospice and Palliative Care, where we try and bring you relevant and useful information to make life better, to be more involved in your health care, and to be able to feel like you're in control. And so we are excited to be here again, and we've got some interesting things going on. I've got a This Week in Hospice story for you, a good one. And
this. We met a lovely lady this week.
We did. Tammy stopped us and let us know that she had listened to the radio station for a long time and had been hearing our show for quite some time. And she tells us the story about her mom, who lives in Texas. And her mom had actually been in the hospice industry. She had been a caregiver for people as they passed. And I believe she said that her mom had always said that she takes care of people until they're ready to go see Jesus. I think that was the phrase. And yet, as she got older,
And had some needs,
her daughter had a hard time having that conversation with her. And so she had, you know, heard the radio broadcast and talked about palliative care. And so she just brought that up to her mom and didn't really think too much about it, but just, you know, palliative care is available. And
right. Just, hey, mom, have you heard about palliative care? I've been listening to this radio program, and they talk a lot about palliative care and how they really help you in your home.
And so then a few weeks later, Tammy's talking to her mom, and her mom says, yeah, the Medicare people, they're sending people in to clean my house.
Right.
You know, of course, we're not taking all the credit for everything that happens across the country, but we're glad that we had that opportunity to share so that somebody else got some benefit that they wouldn't have otherwise. So we're having an effect wider than just this valley or southern Utah, and we're excited about that. But more than that, we're still excited more about having an effect here with people. And it's just a matter of finding the information and then taking advantage of it. And so we hope that we're that source of information.
There really are so many families in need for the support and for the help finding those resources. And we're here for you. We'd love to help. Give our office a call.
And that number is 435, and then the easiest number in southern Utah. 477 on the left and 6999 on the right, just the middle and down at the bottom. You don't have to reach
right,
way
hard
up.
Hard to forget.
That's right. So a few weeks ago, we did a story that we thought was interesting.
And apparently a lot of you thought it was interesting.
It was very interesting.
We got a lot of phone calls and are still getting phone calls about it.
So we wanted to do a quick recap. We don't want to take this whole show to do this, but we did want to recap a little bit and give some, I guess, structure to the conversation and hopefully a little better understanding for everybody. First, that most of the stuff that we try and use here on the radio is well-vetted information. This particular study comes from the National Institute of Health, which is the U.S.'s warehouse of studies on healthcare. Really, they're the ones that keep track of all of the studies that are done and the credibility of them and things like that. So this is published on the NIH's website.
And you will notice that the CDC always refers to the NIH.
Right.
A lot of acronyms in the government. So the CDC refers to the NIH for their studies. Mm-hmm. There are probably 11 or more studies done on this topic.
Right. And so this is actually kind of a culmination of a lot of those different studies, and so this was just a really interesting thing. And if you want the link to the information that we have, give us a call, email us, Richard or Kaylee at PathwayHospiceCare.com. That's Richard at Pathway Hospice Care or Kaylee at Pathway Hospice Care. And we'll get that information for you. You can text us on that telephone number. We'll try and get you that information. But if you've read it and downloaded it, and the jargon is a little bit confusing, we're just going to try and go through this and remove some of that jargon a little bit so that it makes a little more sense. But when you are talking to your doctor, if this is something that is interesting to you or affects you and you want to talk to your doctor, don't be afraid to use that jargon. Take the study with you. Have that conversation with them. Because what we're talking about right now is an academic conversation. It is a conversation about data. And so having the data and being able to provide that data is going to help that conversation. But we also want you to understand that this particular topic, using ivermectin for cancer treatment, is not something that has been approved and probably, based upon what we think we know at this point, will never go through the normal process to be approved as a medication, because in order to be approved, it has to go through human trials. And that's an expensive process. And there is no big pharma company that normally does trials that is willing to do a trial for something that they're not going to be able to make money on.
Yeah, they're not going to have any benefit from an ivermectin medication that's been out for, what, 100 years? So what's the incentive to study that? Mm-hmm. So really, it's kind of incumbent upon you, because there are studies out there, and there are many organizations throughout the world. As a matter of fact, this originally came up from a cancer institute in Spain that is advising one of our patients on, who is also seeking traditional Western medicine treatments of chemotherapy and radiation, and the cancer clinic in Spain was suggesting that she add to it a complementary
therapy
of ivermectin, that it would improve the efficacy of the chemotherapy and radiation. And of course, Richard and I first looked at each other and kind of shrugged our eyebrows and thought, what? And yeah. Then as you did a little study, oh my gosh, I was absolutely flabbergasted at how many studies there really were on their website about it.
Right. So going back to your doctor is, in order to protect himself, herself from litigation, malpractice requires that they only offer proven, what's known as best practice, options for medicine.
And there are standards. There are literally standards of what they can and cannot offer.
Mm-hmm. And so if it's not best practice, and best practice right now for cancer is radiation and chemotherapy and surgery, those are the three, okay? There's some hormone therapies that can be added to that, but the three main ones are surgery, chemotherapy, radiation, and so that's what is always offered. Anything else would not be an offer of best practice. But here's the deal. What your doctor can enter into the conversation with is not the same thing that you can bring to the conversation. So if you bring this conversation to them, they can allow you to enter anything in the conversation, and they can talk about it with you, and they may be able to allow you to do it. They're not the ones who can start it. But as long as they can say, no, this wasn't my idea, this was their idea, they chose it, then, again, the doctor's protected on their side from malpractice. And so you just have to understand what the system is in order to be able to manage within that system.
And I will share with you, I have a family member that is also struggling, suffering with cancer. It is in its late stage. And once we discovered this therapy, really, by one of our other patients who is using it. We did our studies and found it on NIH website, as we just discussed. And then I brought it to this, to my family member, and said, hey, talk to your doctors about this. And can I tell you that their doctors were really, really receptive and said, absolutely, we think you should try it if it's going to, you know, help bring you hope, and let's watch and see how it does, and see if it does increase the efficacy as they go through this chemotherapy and radiation. So now my family member is using it as well, and it's kind of exciting to watch.
So let's just talk about some of the processes. And there's one of the interesting things about ivermectin is it's not a single path towards addressing cancer. There seems to be multiple paths that it can take. All of them have been shown in different studies for different types of cancers. And so we're not going to go through all of that, but I do want to say that the first is it's an antiparasitic. Okay. Now we're coming to some new conclusions about cancer. It used to be that cancer was caused just by spontaneous cell change. But then when you look at spontaneous cell change, you realize that most of the time cells change because of some influence. Viruses, right?
Like they get sick. The yeah. cells get sick. Our bodies don't just automatically start combusting inside.
And they get new code inserted into them. Yeah. You know, when a virus affects a cell, it creates a new code so that cell does something different. And so this antiparasitic actually does reduce viruses, which is part of the reason this was a big thing, you know, a year ago, because there's this whole virus argument, which we're not going to go into today. But if there are viruses that cause cancer and it can eliminate viruses, then it has the potential of eliminating a virus that could cause cancer. That's a pretty simple logic to go through. But that's not the only thing that it does. It's also an anti-tumor. And that means that once a tumor is already there, it can actually force cancer cells to commit suicide. And there's three different ways to do that. Three different triggers for cells, any cells, to commit suicide. But cancer cells seem to commit suicide a lot more. In fact, using ivermectin, they've noticed that the cancer cells will commit suicide and no regular cells do around it, which is incredible. So it can help shrink those tumors, and that's been shown.
Well, clearly that's tied to the fact that the cells that are infected with a virus are those that die off.
That's right.
I mean, you say commit suicide, but they're dying off, right?
And since
your body's flushing them out of the system. So the good, healthy cells remain good, healthy cells.
Right. And so the cancer is all about cell growth, uncontrolled cell growth. But if we can reduce that down, then the cancer is not growing. In fact, it can shrink using that. So it can block cell cycles. There's a certain process that cells go through, and it can impede that so those cells don't get to do that. So in breast cancer, it actually inhibits tumor growth. It can undermine cells' ability to build resistance to chemotherapy, and this is an interesting thing.
There
are many chemotherapy drugs on the market, and the reason that is because cancer cells build immunity to a particular chemotherapy. We're just talking about a chemical, and so these cancer cells are able to address that chemical and say, we're not going to allow that to affect us. But what ivermectin does is it actually reduces the cell's ability to do that. So a chemotherapy that might not have worked in the past may work again under an ivermectin protocol.
Or a single chemotherapy could work longer.
Right. Interestingly, for breast cancer, there are a number of different ways that medicine can address breast cancer. Okay, there's three different ways, but there are breast cancers that are known as triple negative. Well, triple negative means that, and I don't have the specifics on it, but there's three different attacks that we can do. But if none of those attacks work on that breast cancer, then there isn't a therapy that works, except that using ivermectin has been shown to allow that triple negative breast cancer to be affected by those breast cancer treatments. And so it can be an important part of that.
Specifically in the study, it says ivermectin may make breast cancer cells sensitive to tamoxifen. The possibility that ivermectin functions as an epigenetic regulator in the treatment of cancer. And that's a direct quote from the NIH website.
Right. So number seven, it can create an uncomfortable environment for cancer cells, slowing their growth. It just creates an environment where the cancer cells aren't comfortable, and that solves that problem. Let's see, it can enhance drug activity with anti-androgen drug enzalutamide, and if I did that wrong, in prostate cancer. Okay. And so, again, it affects a lot of different cancers in a lot of different ways, and ivermectin preferentially kills leukemia cells at low concentrations without affecting normal hematopoietic cells. Excuse me if I pronounced all those words wrong.
And you probably did.
Probably did. But you can get it in writing so you don't have to depend on me.
Right.
And it just keeps going. There's more to it. So let's see. It has addressed breast cancer, all types of breast cancer, estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, and human. These are the three. Epidermal growth factor receptor 2, HER2. HER2, among the triple negative. It has an effect on gastric cancer, hepatocellular carcinoma, renal cellular carcinoma, prostate cancer, leukemia, cervical cancer, ovarian cancer, brain gliomas, nasopharyngeal carcinoma, lung cancer, melanoma. All of those cancers have been shown to be affected by ivermectin. So if you or anybody you know or anybody that you know that knows somebody, then we would recommend they get that information. Talk to their doctor, get an added treatment in there using ivermectin to solve that problem.
I just think, what the heck, you may as well try it. If it doesn't really have a downside, it has almost no downside at all, why not try it?
So we also, many times, we have an opportunity to work with people who are in this process of losing somebody, and hopefully we get to start early. But there's this process of grieving that we go through, and everybody does it differently. And we know that not everybody's going to have an opportunity to have a grieving process worked out with them. People who die alone, family didn't know, all these things that we've always try and address. The sooner we have an understanding, the sooner everybody does, the sooner we can all start this process together as a team to help each other through this grieving process. From our experiences for grieving, I don't think there's a better thing that can happen than everybody in the family having that opportunity to grieve, to go through these processes while the person is still alive, while they still have an opportunity to share and to have feedback and get some understanding and eliminate a lot of the issues that might exist.
Really, and get comfortable with the conversation. One of the sweetest, most endearing stories I have is from a daughter who, after her mother passed, and she had been suffering with COPD for many years, and in the very final stages, when she had called our company and started the program, and we started encouraging her to have these very direct conversations, after all was said and done, and after her mom passed, she was able to come to our office and thank us for giving her the opportunity to get to the point where she could actually talk to her mom about passing and to ask questions about her fears or what her concerns with when she was gone. And they actually made this really cute promise to each other. And she said to her mom, do whatever you can to make it through, back through, to let me know that you're still with me and watching over me. And they made a promise that she would share pennies with her. And I thought that was so cute, because now every single time she finds a penny on her counter in the morning, in the bathroom in the morning, or if she's walking down the street, it always seems if she's having a bad day, she'll find a penny and she'll be like, thanks, Mom, it's nice to know you're here. But what a beautiful way to be able to have those, get to the point that you're comfortable having those conversations, so that when you say goodbye, not that we're ever ready for it, but we can accept it a little more freely, more willingly.
But we know that many people in this community are not going to have an opportunity for that. End of life can come tragically quick, unknown, and not have that. So there's processes, there's information you should have, either to help yourself or to help somebody else who's going through this grieving process. And it is not comfortable trying to work with somebody in a grieving process, but having some tools would be very helpful. So over course of time, we want to share some things that we think may be helpful, just little tidbits that you can use and think of for yourself or others. And so there are a number of different very good people who have written very good information on this. And so we're just going to relate some of that. One of those is different styles of grieving, and I think that's an important thing. Not everybody grieves in the same way. Story breaks it down into two different categories: intuitive grievers and instrumental grievers. That's not the only way that people can grieve, but we should be able to recognize some things and help understand what grieving can be for somebody. So we all cope with life's biggest challenges in different ways, and learning to cope with death of someone you love is one of the biggest struggles we will ever face. Grief's hard work. It's something you just don't want to do, but you know that you have to, but you don't know if you're going to do it right. You're struggling to feel normal, but you don't even know what that is anymore. All of these feelings come together. Some have said that after the death of a loved one, you just have to develop a new normal. I think that's reasonable. But intuitive grievers, they tend to be feeling-centered. They share their emotions openly. They're interested in dealing with grieving groups, and if that's the case, we'll help you get in touch with those. They're willing to talk more about themselves, whatever their illness is, or the death of that person who died, and they're willing to reminisce about friends and family. And if you can recognize that, then you can find ways to engage them in a comfortable conversation to allow them those opportunities. But on the other side are the instrumental grievers. And those people are more action-oriented. They're like, okay, so what am I going to do now? I need to clean the house. I need to do these other things. That's just part of it. And they don't ever openly talk about it.
They grieve privately.
And they want to assume that responsibility and plan and organize and get that all done. So there's two different parts to that. They're going to be searching for facts and education on it. They're going to spend their time practically instead of emotionally. And if you're presented with either one of those, then you need to come up with some ways to have that conversation. But if you first understand that no two people grieve the same way, and we've all probably heard that tome from the 1960s and 70s, where they had said, well, these are the steps of grieving. This is how you deal with loss, and these steps go in this order. And they don't. Some people don't ever address all the steps. Some of them go through all those steps, but not in any particular order. And you should not at all be surprised when it doesn't work the way somebody planned for you. So if you're helping somebody else, and these are some things to know, don't set a plan for them to grieve. Don't try and figure it out. They're going to have to do it. You can't talk them through it. You can't, you know, give them recommendations of how they're going to deal with it. I think that's one of the biggest things that the profession has finally admitted to, is this person just has to have that opportunity to go through these steps on their own in any way they want to do it.
You know, and it's interesting, as you talk about the intuitive griever and the instrumental griever, I think I was both. I think I was an intuitive griever when my mother passed, but I think I was an instrumental griever when my father passed. And it doesn't mean that I loved them, you know, one more than the other. It was just the way that I processed based on who they were in my life. And being an instrumental griever is what caused us to open this company, actually.
Right, so you adapted to the different circumstances, but you can also recognize that that was two different processes.
It was.
And so if we're helping somebody else, if we're helping ourselves, let's just start by recognizing that our process is our own, and that there may be some things that can indicate how we're going to best deal with it. And so being aware of those things and making sure all the way through, you know, the funeral process can sometimes be more than people imagine. You know, it's not just an opportunity for everybody to get together and talk about the person, but it can also be that process of helping, being there for somebody else, right? Having that support of others around you while you're going through this grieving process, this sense of community that comes together. And so today, I think a lot of people are diminishing what funerals could be. You know, they're thinking, well, we don't need that.
They're more of a celebration of life than a mourning of death.
Right. But the secondary part of that is we are still in this together. We are still working on our own issues as a group instead of trying to do it solo. And so it's always better to have people around you, as long as they're not just annoying you with, you know, processes that you don't want to do.
Or telling you how you should be grieving or how should be getting over it. There's no right or wrong. You have to go through your own individual process. I would say the only thing that must happen is you must learn to accept the death and find a new normal. That doesn't mean that you're moving on or forgetting the person. It means that you're accepting the death and being able to live even though your loved one has passed.
You use that phrase, moving on, and I think that's been used often. You really have to move on from here, and it's not the case. You're not leaving anything behind.
Right. No,
we're moving forward, right? We're taking that next step, but we are not trying to separate ourselves from anything in the past. You bring that loved one right along with you.
You absolutely do. You get to bring their memories, their experiences, their life story with you. Their life experience has made you who you are, if they were an important part of your life. So you don't forget them. They just have a different place next to you.
Right. So hold on to those memories, enjoy them and cherish them and share them with others so that you can build a better understanding and a better sense of community or family, a better sense of family, being able to work together. It's exciting to be here on the radio and try and share these things, and we really hope that we're giving you some useful tools. This is going to be one of those things we'll cover again in different ways, because we have a feeling that some of you are going to end up in that position of being the person that is going to help, because everybody else is too afraid. I've been there. How do you have that conversation with somebody? It's hard to do.
But don't be offended by the word moving on. Just define what the term meaning on means to you.
All right. We look forward to your telephone calls, 435-477-6999. And we look forward to seeing you next week.
Thanks, or hearing everyone. You next week. Have a great week.